Greetings! I am Farida. This is the Slow Dive Podcast. This episode is a co-production with the Creative Seat Podcast as well, because we have a creative powerhouse. Writer, director, producer Lisa Cole is with us today. We will dive into her film journey, inspiration, and impact. Her short film, Bienvenidos a Los Angeles, was Oscar shortlisted for the 96th Academy Awards. Bienvenidos, Lisa. How are you?
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to say also welcome to Sam.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Lisa, for joining us on this co-production. Thank you, Farida. It's always a pleasure collaborating with you.
Thank you to you guys for having me on and for the shout out for the short film, Bienvenidos. Thanks so much.
Yeah, that was a special film. We're going to get into that in our impact segment. But first, Lisa, if you had to pick four words to describe yourself, what four words would you use?
Empathic or empathetic, resilient, passionate, and resourceful. I'd say resourceful. I'm pretty resourceful. Creative too, but that's five.
No, that's an important one. You are creative, no doubt. Wonderful. Resourceful. I mean, that's a very important word, right? Like when you're a writer, director, producer. So good one. Absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. You're out here in LA. You have, you're a mom, an artist.
I am a mom and an artist and an advocate. I've been telling stories, sharing stories primarily about women and that are underdogs that kind of come from neglect and that find redemption and self-empowerment. And I realized that during COVID when I went for a walk one day. And I was just sort of thinking about some of my projects that I've been pursuing. And I just realized that, oh, wow, they all stem from neglect, which is kind of a very personal place in my own life that I've had to kind of rise above. But yeah, I live here in Los Angeles. I am married. We actually just celebrated 20 years. Crazy.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Kind of is a big milestone. And we have two children and we have a whole crazy zoo of animals. We now have three dogs and two cats. And my husband's like, what is going on? So we are at capacity and we are busy.
Well, great. Well, I love that. I mean, I feel like you have a lot of muse and inspiration on day to day with animals, children, a husband, all this. So it does probably
chaos. All the time. Yeah. My friend who has even more kids than me, they have three children. They're always like, just embrace the chaos. Okay. That's actually hard for me to do, but I'm learning.
Yeah. What is embracing chaos? Just leaning into it. I mean, it's just like, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, life is really just sort of out of our control as much as people like myself who are type A like to control things and have things controlled. There's really no control. The older I get, I'm learning to kind of just lean into that. And with that comes imperfection and messiness and chaos and just realizing that it's all about the moment and kind of going with it and making it what it can be. A lot of times even too, like right when you're filming, you can be as prepared as possible. And I'm a big advocate for being prepared. But when you get there, it's not always in your control, right? And so it's like about being able to roll with the punches and roll with the reality and before you. And maybe it'll even be something better than you could have manufactured because you're open to that spontaneity and serendipity and chaos.
So you used the word resourceful earlier, and we were talking about chaos and leaning into it as part of the creative process. How does that work with like your writing and writer's, director's hat and producer's hat? Like, do you get to use both sides of your brains daily, or do you like switch off and put on your producer's hat and or just writer's hat? Or when you start your creative process, how does that work for you?
It all sort of bleeds together. I feel like it all sort of bleeds together. For me, it's really hard to kind of compartmentalize because also now, you know, having been in the business for a while, it's like you, when you're writing, it's hard not to think also as a producer in terms of like, I want to make this doable, shootable, you know, realistic, not some logistical nightmare, right? But yeah, but also just trying to find the freedom of form to be creative where you're not worried about those things. So yeah, it's I don't know. The more you know, I guess it's a blessing and a curse because you know what it takes to get a film made. But at the same time, you want to just let creative juices go where they may, right? Flow with the river, go where it goes.
Okay. So what was younger Lisa before Los Angeles? What was the early inspiration or event that catalyzed your film career or set you off in this direction into entertainment, writing and producing and directing? Did you always know that you were going to be a filmmaker? Is that something you've known forever? Or
I was born in Southern California, but my parents went through this really icky divorce when I was 5. And then when I was 10, my mom became a born-again Christian, and we moved to a little town in Arkansas from here. And everyone was like, you're doing what? You know, you're going where? To my mom. And as kids, we just thought, oh, this is going to be a fun adventure. And that's a crazy story. And I won't tell all of that now. But, you know, it really shaped who I became as a person and also as an artist. And one interesting tidbit is that, I mean, I love the South. I have a love-hate with it. You know, politically, I don't love everything about it, but I love its visceralness and the sounds of cicadas and the humidity and like big ass beetles and bugs and, you know, fireflies. And like, there's so much tapestry to the South, like my DNA. And I'm so thankful for that experience. And I go back and forth a lot now, even though when I lived there as a, you know, teenager, I couldn't wait to get the F out of Dodge. But that was because they did things like dumb things like banned MTV from my county, you know, in high school. And there was all kinds of sort of puritanical, you know, patriarchal walls to kind of like scaffold. And so I do have my mom and Arkansas to thank for much. One of the things, big things, was this performing educational, like philanthropic group came through town one weekend, and they were called Up With People, and they're still around today. Anyway, I didn't want to go, and my mom went. She was like, I'm going to go down there and you should come with me, because I had been doing theater and dance, and that was sort of what I was passionate about. For whatever reason, though, because maybe because my mom said it was a good idea, I didn't want to go. So I remember I stayed home and she went to the show, and she called me and she afterward, and she was like, you need to get your butt down here right now, because these are your people and you need to come. They're interviewing young people your age to go and travel with them. And you know, thank God she made that phone call, because it was life changing. And I went down there sort of begrudgingly, and I went down, you know, as a surly teen, and I went down there, and then I ended up interviewing with several of the performers. They were called students in the program because it really was an educational program. And, you know, I met someone from Sweden and someone from Arizona, and suddenly it seemed really appealing to me, because here was a group of 100 young people from like 20 different countries, and they were in my town for the weekend, and they were performing and visiting and doing, you know, like educational programming and like philanthropic things. And I just thought it was really cool. And my mom was right. And I ended up doing it for a year as a student. And then they offered me a job in which I stayed for another 2 years on their staff in charge of the production. And so I taught the dance, maintained the choreography, led rehearsals, and performed every night. But the biggest part of all of it, besides the lifelong friendships that I've made and all the traveling, which I love, is that I lived with 201 host families in 12 countries in 3 years. And that experience as a young person completely changed my life. It opened up an entire world and palette for other food and cultures and affinity for like lifelong learning, you know. And it's just, so I feel like I've been championing these kinds of like diverse stories of people and women and underdogs and, you know, for a really long time before diversity was like a buzzword now, you know, like I've it's just sort of part of who I am. And it's definitely shaped the types of things that I'm interested in doing and projects and people that I like to work with. And so, yeah, that was kind of the biggest influence on my life, I would say.
I love that. So with community, the global community now seeming smaller, did you find any commonality within your writing and your early experiences now? I mean, you're sourcing stories from that time as a young person, traveling, let's say it's a younger, young person listening to this, like, what did that give you besides just like giving you a cultural exchange and learning more about different cultures and people and all that? For you as a writer, as a woman, and as an American, because a lot of us, you know, don't travel as much as we should. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. I don't know if this statistic is still true, but a few years ago, I heard that only about 5% of the U.S. population has a passport. And I mean, part of that is socioeconomic, and I understand it. It's traveling is expensive. But also, you just wonder if there's like a lack of curiosity there and this sort of nationalism that we're seeing a rise in, where people are, you know, not so friendly to outsiders, quote unquote. But for me, yeah, I think the biggest thing it taught me traveling internationally as a young person and being in situations where I was definitely a minority or I didn't speak the language, and all of those things are so good because it teaches you a lot about yourself, but also how to communicate with others, even without words. And that's what I kind of learned, is that while we need to celebrate our differences, there's also so many things that we hold in common as human beings. So I try to take that into my writing, and, you know, it certainly informed my most recent project, the short film Bienvenidos, but also other things that I write. So in Pursue. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that. And yes, I do think that's really sad that socioeconomically it's challenging for a lot of people to travel. I think there's a desire to, but also culturally. Yeah, I agree with you. Besides your travels and your personal experiences, when you're wanting to write something, because you write and direct your own stuff, but obviously you want to direct other people's works as well. But for your stuff, how do you kind of get your inspiration? Is there like a wheelhouse or a theme or a topic that you kind of cater to that speaks to you more so, aside from, like you were saying, women's stories, underdogs, but like, are there other sources?
Well, I have one project set in upstate New York, in Newburgh, which is a really vibrant Afro-Caribbean community. There's a large diaspora up there of West Indian people. And, you know, before working on that project, I did not realize that the majority of Black Americans are actually made up of Caribbean people and West Indian. That's like the largest population in the U.S., which I thought was really fascinating. And when I started working on this project, you know, I also didn't realize that there's just not really very many stories by and about those communities. And so it wasn't the impetus for it. But what happened is I just was there in Newburgh working on something else, and I happened to meet this young woman who's Afro-Caribbean, and she lives in Newburgh. And we became friends over like the course of 6 months, you know. I think it was a really unlikely friendship in the sense of we're very separated in terms of age and also geography, you know, East Coast, West Coast, and then I'm white and she's Black. But we found these commonalities in our childhood and our upbringing that allowed us to bond. And so I went back and visited her, and we would communicate on social media, and she would share stories with me about her life. And I asked her, you know, if she would like to try to write a screenplay inspired by events in her life, and that we could do it together, and I would help shepherd that. And she said yes. And so we have written a screenplay about that. And so that's one way that I found a story, you know, just meeting somebody that was really interesting and who had a wonderful story to share that I think that can really resonate. For me, it resonated in my bones. And so when I feel that kind of level of vibration or excitement, I feel like I know that it will speak to other people too. Just I have to trust that instinct. Yeah. And so we are now collaborating with a young, talented Trinidadian director who graduated recently from Columbia and has already made her first feature. And so now she's also a writer on the project, and it's called Queen of Newburgh. And we are out to financiers now. We're beginning that process. So that was one way of developing a project. I also recently had optioned a book. So I have IP to another amazing story, a true story. You know, one of my projects was literally on the cover of the California section of the LA Times. And it's a screenplay that I've now written called Girl Named Sue. And when I saw, but before it was a script, it was a story of this real woman in Northern California who works to save kids in dangerous drug homes. At the time, it was primarily crystal meth homes from these rural sort of clandestine labs happening in Northern California. And there was this picture on the cover of the paper that she was bent over in a flak vest, but she had these long manicured nails and she was bent over trying to talk to this young, like 10-year-old boy who just had his head down and he was standing in all this filth in his home and he had so much shame. You could just see it in his body language. And that photo just floored me. I started, sat down and read the article and started crying. And I remember it was a Saturday. And I told my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, I was like, I need to tell this. I need to talk to this woman. I want to tell this story. I want to go and meet her. And it's been a really long journey with that project. We got really close and we've gotten close many times. And I feel like we'll still make it when the time is right. We're regrouping on it now. I just try to stay open to things. And then I guess they find me in that way. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like you're very heart-led and centered. That's like your compass.
Because it takes so much work to do this, as you guys both know. And I hate to say this because I don't want to discount anyone's work or experience or belittle it in any way because I respect it all. But I just don't personally don't care enough to just make like genre pictures or something. Because it's just too effing hard that I would rather go and do something else. You know, if I can't tell these sort of heart-led, passionate projects, I suppose. And I've been told recently by a producer that all my projects are, quote, uphill battles. And I'm like, well, yeah, but aren't most things that are worth fighting for in this industry? So that's just BS. That just means that that person's not the right collaborator. And no means new opportunity.
Yeah, there's an audience for every film. There's a producer for every project. And yeah. I agree with that sentiment. But you do have to be passionate about your project and get excited about your story to commit such a long period of time in development and then raising funding and then going into production. So yeah, you can't do stuff that doesn't speak to you. Like if it doesn't speak to you, you can't get excited about it, then you lose steam, right? Like you have to, and everyone I think on a project needs to be just as passionate in moving the film along and getting it to the audience. Otherwise, yeah, it kind of slows down the process, and I agree. Well, that's interesting. Queen of Newburgh is one of your latest projects that you're up and coming, or you're still in development right now?
Well, we just finished the draft of the script where all three of us are really happy. So that would be Maya, the director, and Ronnie, the young woman who co-wrote it with me, and then myself. So yeah, so now we have our team in place, and now we are strategizing the next steps in terms of financing. And we've applied for some opportunities that we're waiting to hear about and that we're starting to have meetings. So it's exciting. You know, although they say it's a terrible time for drama. I even heard one person say, oh, drama's dead. And I'm like, I started laughing. I'm like, okay, that's a really short-sighted view because this is a very cyclical industry and drama, excuse me, has been in our DNA since the beginning of time. And people always want dramatic stories. And that's not to say we don't need more comedy and people want escapism too, of course. But I just don't see drama going away. And you can only do so much horror and sci-fi. I mean, come on, you know, like that's going to suddenly the market's going to be flooded with that. And then they're going to be like, oh, no horror sci-fi. Our dockets are full. So, you know, that's where we're headed. I literally applied to this one thing today and it's all about horror and sci-fi. And I was like, well, we don't check that box. So they had a category called wild card. And I'm like, all right, we'll apply under wild card because we don't fit the genre that you're looking for. So anyway.
I know, I love that. But you know, that's so true, right? Actually, what I've been hearing a lot, because, you know, I'm just from the industry talk and the indie micro budget world, that's the world I am at the moment. It's like rom-com. Do you have a rom-com? Do you have a horror? But in drama, I think drama is still in demand. But yeah, not just drama flat. No, like, what is the world of the story? And like, what kind of drama? Is it a family drama, a crime drama? Is it a period piece? Like, I mean, there's layers to that. Yeah, I don't think drama's it. I think drama's very much alive. And yes, it will boom and bust cycle in the story world. We will tap out. Like, we will get sick of horror and sci-fi at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't personally even watch those two genres. Mm-hmm. So I might be missing out, but I don't know. Yeah. Give me a good drama or I love movies that are inspired by true stories or dramedy. You know, I really like dramedy. I mean, give me American Fiction. That was amazing, right? That film was able to straddle both, you know, did dramedy very well. I loved it. Yeah.
I think horror can be interesting too. I started off in horror, but
yeah. I don't mean to disparage any genre. It's just
No. Okay, so what do you think like the future of storytelling? I know we talked about this is what the buzzwords are right now, is horror and sci-fi, but what do you think with the streamers and all these like changes since the pandemic, the writer's strike, and now all these merging studios, and what do you think the future of storytelling is for creators right now? Or what do you speculate, if you could put it out there, as a writer, director, producer yourself?
Yeah, I don't think anybody knows. I don't think anybody knows anything at the moment. I think we're in a very tumultuous time, which is scary, but also out of that usually comes disruption. So that's a good thing. And people are working behind the scenes to try to figure out what the next thing is going to look like in terms of distribution platforms and content pipelines. And I was fortunate enough to be invited to this very small brunch at Sundance this year that was only for like 50 people in a private house one morning. And then they had a breakfast and a very informal, like gathered around kind of panel talk where we just sat on the floor and the staircase. And, you know, and it was like the head of TikTok and the head of, you know, Gold House. And so Bing Chen was there and the head of Canopy. Sharon Waxman was there, you know, Dan Kogan was there, the head of Impact Partners, like head of Story Syndicate, like all, you know, these big heads of industry and titans of documentary primarily, but also narrative were there in the room, and some independent producers too. And this was the question on everybody's mind, of course, but no one had the answer. And I think it's a really interesting time because, of course, everyone's trying to figure out, like, how do we take our content and go straight to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everybody would like. That's what everyone's trying to figure out. Like, how do we bypass this current pipeline of streamers who are buying very little and have turned into studios themselves?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Sundance, which used to be the preeminent place for documentary sales, even 5-6 years ago, no longer is. And everything is changing, and it's scary for Sundance, and it's scary for festivals, it's scary for creators, everybody. But out of that scariness comes, right, change usually. So it's just like we're in growing pains right now until we figure out the next thing. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't have like any kind of magical answers, because the big takeaway from that brunch was nobody knows yet, but everyone's trying to figure it out. All we can do is keep talking and sharing information and be as transparent as possible. And you know, because I didn't want to be like the Debbie Downer that day, but I like raised my hand and said, hey, I want to just bring up something, because I have two tweens. I have teenage, you know, a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old. And I said, so what we're not talking about right now is what about the next generation? And they are used to consuming short content for free. And nobody is addressing that. And literally one of the people said, well, it's really up to you as the parents to make sure your kids are watching long form in documentaries and rah, rah, rah. And I was like, how out of touch is that? Like, first of all, we do, because we create those projects, and my husband does a lot of big documentaries. And so we have made them sit down in front of programming that probably half the country kids have never seen, because just because of the nature of what we do and who we are. So they've seen a lot of things, and they'd still rather be on Roblox, TikTok, and YouTube. You know, my daughter will tell you right now, I hate documentary. And I'm like, she just does that to irk us, but she's 12. But literally, you know, it's a thing that we need to be thinking about. And I don't think that long form is going to go away, but we are raising this generation of kids who stare at this tiny screen and they watch tidbits of short clips of stupid things, and they're entertained. And
we're at a cultural divergence right now where we're going with storytelling. And yes, the attention spans are very limited, not just kids and this younger generation, like adults as well. Like, I mean, a lot of us are kind of like on the short form. But one of the things, I don't know, Lisa, if you've heard this, but it is very uncertain. And just talking about the uncertainty and the shifting landscape of our entertainment industry is, I think, comforting to other filmmakers and creators and directors and producers, because we are all trying to figure it out. With the streamers having talent producers, actor producers who have a lot more visibility, I think, yeah, the indie darlings of Sundance, Tribeca, and TIFF and all that, where people would get a lot of buzz and visibility, is diminishing. But despite that, I mean, have you thought about, or have you created short form content? Is that something you see yourself getting into, like from adapting from your feature world and maybe creating like a series or directing something like that?
No, I haven't really gone that route yet, to be honest. Sorry.
No, you're a loyalist to feature films. So that's a good thing. No, that's a good thing. It is Women's History Month when we're recording this. How do you feel about like women producers and directors? I mean, Barbie, of course, was a phenomenal hit and your film did really great and it was shortlisted for the Oscars and a lot of women creators. But like, what do you think women directors and producers need more of or could benefit from if there were to be any changes in Hollywood?
I'm all for everyone getting paid. Everyone needs to. But I feel like I'm with Cord Jefferson. It's like, why make one $20 million film, you know, when you could make, I don't know the math, but 20 lower budget films or 40 lower budget projects for that same price, you know? And that way, if there's more of a sense of risk on a first-time director or a female director or whatever, that there's not as much, you know, to risk and lose financially. I mean, because I think the cost of movies has just gotten outrageous. You don't really need that much to tell a really good story. It's crazy, you know? I don't know. It's so hard to even come up with like $1 million for a first-time director. And there's like distribution models where, oh, we don't really want to buy anything that's less than 2 point whatever. Or I don't know. There's all these magical numbers that keep shifting and changing in terms of what makes something union, non-union, or I don't know. It's probably too complicated a conversation for this.
No.
I don't even know about enough to be able to be the one to talk about it. I don't know. It's a good question. What needs to shift for women directors? I mean, obviously continuing to give one another more opportunities and
create more opportunities for women to produce higher budget films. If they are $20 million projects, shifting gears, how do you build teams for your projects? Like, is there any tips that you could give our audience? Is there any insight? Because I know you've produced and wrote and directed many films now. So when you're building teams and having that collaborative synergy, like, what are some things that you look for that's a good team? And what are some things you pass on, if you could share?
Well, it's really hard to know, right? Unless you've just come out of film school and you have your tribe. And you guys roll out of that program and, you know, you're all making projects together. That's the ideal thing. But I've been out of film school for a while. And then I was working as a writer for so long that I sort of lost that, you know, production tribe. So I had to kind of amass it again when I was going to shoot Bienvenidos. I wanted to keep it small, but it still needed at least a 20-person crew. And so, yeah, I think we ended up around 22, 23 people on the crew. And so, actually, Women in Media was great for that. So, you know, being a part of these different organizations where you can try to organically meet people that you seem aligned with. But even still, you know, I had to work with a lot of people that I hadn't worked with before. And that can always be tricky because you hope that you're trusting your instincts and you hope that you make the right choices. I mean, it has happened to me in the past where I, you know, thought I picked the right person and then had to kind of move on from that. And that's difficult. But boy, I was glad I did in the long run and trusted my instincts, you know, and it's tricky, right? Because it's like a marriage. And especially with your producers, like you really want, ideally your team you need to have each other's back. And that's not always the case, you know? And like you were mentioning earlier, unfortunately, there's, you know, even though we're trying to like work with women and make a concerted effort, sometimes there's mean girls that slip in there and you just don't know sometimes until it's kind of like until you're embedded and it's like, oh, crap.
It can be traumatizing, Lisa. I don't know about you, but it can be. You got to have that resiliency and tough skin to get back and build a new team again and be like, oh, my God, I hope it doesn't happen again. I hope I we're all on the same page.
I'm working on this one project where I literally had to let the two producers go. when I realized they were mean girls, you know, and I remember asking this one producer after a 4-hour frustrating conversation, like, I just had to go, okay, wait, tell me again, please tell me, why are you working on this project? Like, why are you in this? And she couldn't answer. And I knew right then and there, like her heart was not in the right place. And I just knew, like, this is done. And then it was a painful extraction process, but at least I had clarity, you know? And then you have to just, I literally feel like, you know what? I went through that ickiness because I needed to grow more balls. I needed to be able to stand in my power and go, nope, this is not working. This is not what's best for the project or me, you know, as the creator, like, not a good fit. And it was hard, but I need to just stand in that power and learn to do that. And I'm learning to do that more. And I'm so glad I did, because now I'm with, you know, a much better team.
I love that, because yes, that resonates, I think, with a lot of us who are listening. Yeah, reclaiming your power, but it's almost kind of like an initiation, right? Like, I have to go through that so you know what not to do next time and how to vet better teammates for projects. And I think everybody, men or women, anybody in the industry has these like stories of like projects that kind of fizzled out, dismantled, or was too much egos involved. And it wasn't about the project anymore. It was about everybody's like ego. And
or literally just like, literally, I had this one person like redo a budget, and suddenly there were these new line items that benefited them. And I was like, wait, okay, so we're increasing the budget by X amount, but what's your plan to how to raise the money? You know, and they didn't have an answer. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. That's not going to work. So anyway, yeah, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, as the director, you have to know so much, because you got to be able to read a room. You got to be able to read the budget, understand the budget. You have to know contracts. You have to know, you know, sometimes you just want to be in this creative bubble and be like, I just want to focus on the writing and the directing. But it's, you really have to, unfortunately, you have to wear all hats kind of all the time. But it would be nice to kind of have the opportunity to just maybe focus more on the art part of it.
We're all multi-hyphenates, right? I mean, you lean on one area first. I think coming back from those experiences, yes, I mean, you're stronger, you're better for it, and now you know what not to do, and you get better with each film, each project. So
absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so now talk about this amazing film that I was so happy to be a part of as well, Bienvenidos a Los Angeles. It's an impact film. It was nominated, Oscar shortlisted for the 96th Academy Awards this year, inspired by a true story, and is screened over 60 festivals globally. It's done really, really well. Tell our audience how this film came about.
Thank you for that great introduction to the film, too. Yeah, so it's a great story in terms of, again, it was a true story, and that's what I tend to gravitate towards, but it was a story that I had lived firsthand as well. So really, it's a story. The movie is about three women helping each other in the City of Angels. And it tells the story of this Nigerian woman who's on the path to getting her green card. And suddenly the Muslim ban jeopardizes that. The rug is pulled out from underneath her. She ends up in a rideshare that night on her way home. And she's received a letter at work that says she has to leave the country within 30 days. And so she's on her way home, just totally distraught, doesn't know what to do. She's also a single mother. And in the rideshare, she meets the rideshare driver, who's also a grandmother, who's been in the country as an immigrant for 29 years. And then she meets this young woman, Elizabeth, who's a single mother, who is on her way to the airport to pick up her son, who she's not seen in 5 years, and he's only 6 years old. So I wrote it so that the Nigerian character is feeling, you know, at first she's feeling helpless over her situation. And then when she meets Elizabeth, she realizes, you know what, all is lost anyway. I can help this other person and do something good to help this other person. even though I can't really help myself in this moment in her own situation. So I think she, you know, frustrated by her own situation, she offers to help this other woman reunite with her young son by going into the airport to get him, since this other woman is undocumented and can't go into the airport without the fear of being deported. So yeah, so it becomes this beautiful story of the women helping women. And it does have this hopeful ending, which I know is not the case for many, many stories similar to this. But in real life, you know, I was inspired to tell this story from the true story of my former babysitter, Elizabeth, who, when I met her, she was already separated from her son for several years. And when he turned 5, I remember talking to her and she was just so upset. And, you know, he was about to start school. And she said, I think I've got to either go back to Mexico or I got to figure out how to bring him here, because he was a U.S. citizen and he had papers, but she had taken him back to Mexico when he was only 1. So that she could continue working here. And I met her, like I said, a few years after that. We used to just cry together a lot over the fact that they were separated and how much she missed Chris. And so I only got to know him, you know, on her FaceTime, on her phone. So this actually happened under Obama, because at that time, he had deported more people than any other president to that point in time. But it wasn't until the Muslim ban under another administration that I remembered the story in terms of, like, wow, it was so infuriated by what I was hearing on the news about family separation and through the Muslim ban that I remembered Elizabeth's story and I was looking for something to direct. And so I called her and we're still very close. Here's my idea. What would you think? Thankfully said yes and trusted me to tell her story. And she really was eager to share it because she believes that, you know, a lot of women can relate to the shoes that she was standing in. And so, yeah, so we set out to do this thing together and to tell this story, to put a face of humanity on a really complicated issue, which is immigration.
And it's a beautiful film. And I know why it's done so well and it's resonated with so many. One thing our audience does not know, you also did a give back to the San Fernando Refugee Center that really helped their children's program. That was really pivotal. So this film has been opening hearts and opening discussions and dialogues on that. And congratulations again for being shortlisted on that. I mean, you are definitely an impactful filmmaker, Lisa. And I'm so happy to know you as a writer, and I'm inspired by your process and everything that you bring to the industry. But like, yeah, listening today to like how you source your inspiration, real life experiences, and channel the underdog and bring resilience and reframe that into impact, I think it really paints a beautiful picture of who you are as a filmmaker that took out and saw the world and now is bringing the world back and making it feel like a smaller home for all of us where we can all be interconnected and related. So I love that. And I'm really excited to see what else you create in the future. And I know it's going to be amazing, but of course I can say that, but I know that. So going forward, as we close out today's interview, I wish we could be on here for a couple more hours, but what would be your ideal project? If there was like something you want to work on or create or produce or work with, I mean, if there was no constraints, let's just say, or there was like a nice budget, like what would you like to create in the next few years for yourself, or produce, direct, and write?
Well, first of all, thank you for all those very kind words. I'm very flattered, and it's so nice of you to kind of frame everything that way, and appreciate that you see my work that way. And thank you. And thanks for being a big part of it, to both of you, Farida and Sam, because you both helped so much with the impact. And we did that wonderful online screening and then another in-person screening for the Refugee Children's Center. And I really couldn't have done it without you guys. So thank you. One thing I do want to say is just that I think that when society likes to put people in boxes and give labels to things and label people, right? And it's very limiting. And so for me, I want to use my gifts and as a creator to help break that down and to show that, you know, when we can see beyond those sort of societal labels, that like a kinder world emerges, you know, as we can see one another as these sort of beautiful, complex human beings that we all are. So that's sort of what drives me and the kind of the compass for what I'm looking to do next, and trying to tell universal stories that have redemption in them. And I have a whole slate of projects that I want to do next. So I feel like I'm just getting going, and the Oscar shortlist has been such a blessing. It was, first of all, it was really fun and amazing to be on that list of 15 films with people like Wes Anderson and Pedro Almodovar and Ethan Hawke, Pedro Pascal, John, you know, John Travolta. I mean, it was nuts. On the one hand, I don't necessarily think that super established filmmakers should be allowed to compete in that category. Maybe not everyone agrees with me, but I feel like it should sort of be reserved for emerging filmmakers, which I believe is how it kind of started out. On the other hand, it's such an honor to be on the list with them. So I have a slate of other projects that are mostly all inspired by true stories that I was just writing a one pager for one of them today that takes place down in the bayou that follows a woman that, you know, right after the Deepwater Horizon spill, which happened, or not spill, but explosion that happened like 14 years ago. And I know her, and it's a true story about her and her advocacy and her journey to becoming an advocate. And that's a really inspiring story as well.
Seems like you got a pretty full slate there, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining Fam and I in our little co-production today. I think I can say at least I'm inspired by meeting fellow writer-directors like yourself. It gives us the motivation to keep persisting in this industry, which it is hard at times, but then you see people doing it and persisting and it's paying off and they're doing nicer, bigger projects. It's inspiring to hear your career journey. And we're very happy that you were able to join us in my newbie podcast and Sam's creative seat.
Yes. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Farida. It's been a great conversation. And Lisa, you also inspire me. Like I truly believe that if I'm going to pick up a project, I want to pick up something and give my 100% plus when I'm passionate about the story that I'm telling. And so I really think that, you know, like this conversation will inspire other filmmakers and other creatives in general to embrace their passion and work towards a goal.
Yeah, I hope it's helpful to somebody. I hope so, yeah.
Well, everybody, this brings us to the end of our episode with the amazing, super creative powerhouse writer, director, producer, Lisa Cole. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Sam, for joining us today. This is The Slow Dive. I am Farida. Let's make an impact one episode at a time.